You're listening to the Christian Humanist Radio Network, ChristianHumanist.org.
We're going to draw a little bit of everybody's blood. We're going to find out who's the thing. Watching Norris in there gave me the idea that maybe every part of him was a whole. Every little piece was an individual animal with a built-in desire to protect its own life. You see, when a man bleeds, it's just tissue. The blood from one of you things won't obey when it's attacked. It'll try and survive. Crawl away from a hot needle, say.
Welcome all to this episode of The City of Man. As you might have already guessed, this isn't Coyle Neal. This is David Grubbs. Usually I'm on the Christian Humanist podcast, but it's Halloween week, which means we're mixing things up. We're doing the great John Carpenter film crossover this week, and the City of Man episode is 1982's film The Thing. With me is Jordan Poss, who is relatively frequently on City of Man. Is that correct?
Yeah, less so recently. It's slowed down a good bit, but yeah, I've been around.
Excellent. Also with us is Carter Stepper, who's usually hanging out with Danny Anderson, but welcome, sir.
Thanks very much. Happy to be here to talk about one of my very favorite movies.
Well, it's been a favorite of mine for a pretty long time. I can't say that I saw it in the theater. There's no way my parents would have let 4-year-old David see The Thing in the theater. But
I was born 4 years later, so I definitely didn't see it either.
Given that it was impossible. I did see it as a young teenager on video cassette at a friend's house. Say what?
I was going to say it flopped horribly at the time, too. I think it took a couple of years for it to really get a following on VHS.
Yeah, that's true. I we should probably say something about that in a little bit, but 1982 would have been a really tough year for this movie to drop. It had a lot of pretty tough competition in the science fiction and the horror market.
Well, I believe it opened the same. Go ahead.
Oh, sorry. I was just going to say, and just as a note I'm a pretty big John Carpenter fan in general, not as big as Danny, mind you, but my impression is that the majority of his films became much more popular as cult classics than they were in the theater. There's only a handful that actually did well out of the gate. Mm-hmm. So.
Yep. He's one of those directors that, Blockbuster was kind to, I think.
Yeah. Word of mouth.
Well, let's say something really quickly about just the movie as a movie. For those who haven't seen The Thing, you can rent it on whatever your streaming service of choice is. Probably, I believe I rented it off of Amazon Prime, but I think it's on Netflix as well. I couldn't find my own DVD of it, which is up in a box in the attic somewhere, rooted through until my dust allergies got the best of me and I had to flee. But yeah, you should watch it on your own, dear listener. But either one of you want to give kind of a thumbnail recap before we start doing some more analysis?
I could do that, unless Jordan is really wanting to.
Oh, no, go for it.
Okay, so the movie starts with us seeing a alien spacecraft fall from the sky into, it doesn't really tell us, but we assume is some kind, or we find out later, is a earlier age in Earth's history. And then it cuts to a dog running across a white plane, followed by a helicopter shooting at it. And I'm not going to go through every single scene, guys. I'm just sort of getting going here.
UFO, dog.
UFO, dog. And what we then go to is we see this group of American researchers at an Antarctic outpost who watch this happen, watch this helicopter crash, watch all this death and this, and then they take this dog in, and they're very confused as to why these Norwegians, who they find out that the other research team is the ones chasing the dog, shooting at it. They don't understand them. None of them speak Norwegian, but they hear them saying something and watch them basically all perish due to an accidental explosion. And they take this dog in. What quickly becomes apparent, however, is that this dog is some kind of extraterrestrial. Well, that's probably not at the beginning, but it ends up gooping onto other dogs in the pen. And what happens is we see that this creature seems to take on the form of other creatures, and then when necessary transmute them. And the scary part of this is that it can take any form. And so as the movie progresses, what we find is that these, I believe it's 8 men, are unsure who the thing is, because it can look like any of them. And so the movie transpires, starring, of course, Kurt Russell and one of his many partnerships with John Carpenter to incredible effect, I would say, one of his better roles, is trying to find a way to determine who has been infected and, in fact, has been replaced by this this creature, which seems to spread something like a virus. They come up with a means of doing so by basically introducing flame or an electrical charge to blood. And so they come up with a blood test. And over the course of the rest of the film is basically the alien weeding out the various humans until all that's left at the end, with a flamethrower and a smart comment about, let's just sit here a while, is Kurt Russell's character and I forget the actor's name, but one other survivor, as the rest of the base burns around them, and we are left with an ambiguous ending of not knowing whether the thing continues to exist or not. Now, there's a lot of details I, of course, left out there, but that is the basic overarching story. Is there anything else you guys are like, okay, you know, you left out something pretty important for people listening to this episode?
No, I can't think of anything. I mean, as we dig down into the details, as we'll have to, we can kind of just, hey, remember the thing we said about it replacing people? Well, here's a scene. And go from there. One of the things that I am reminded of every time I come back to this film is just how many people are in it. Mm-hmm. I, for whatever reason, if I let my memory grow dim, I think of it as a rather small ensemble piece. But then when I rewatch it, I'm like, there's a lot of guys at this base. So are there any particular performances that really stand out to y'all? You already mentioned Kurt Russell, Carter.
Well, Wilford Brimley, of course, who taking a break from peddling oatmeal and talking about diabetes, gives a really, no, it's actually, this I think is, if it's not his first performance, his first acting gig, it's one of his first, because he got into acting pretty late in life. He is pretty fantastic as the doctor who pretty much picks up on what the game is like really quickly, and so secludes himself and sort of semi-insanely is trying to stay away from the others because he actually understands the import of what's happening around them. His role is pretty great because he's kind of like the one who gets it, but in a sort of Lovecraftian sense, which again, I would argue this is a Lovecraftian style, a cosmic horror style story. He's the sort of Lovecraftian academic who goes crazy because he's encountered the thing that has come from beyond. So yeah, I really like his performance.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And he has a Charles Foster Kane level room trashing scene.
That's so great.
It's just fantastic.
Yeah. I mean, like, if you ever wanted to see Wilford Brimley with, oh gosh, he's got an axe at one point and a gun. Yeah. It's, if you didn't know you needed that scene, you do.
You think that thing wanted to be an animal? No dog can make it 1,000 miles to the coast. No, you don't understand. That thing wanted to be us. Joe gets out. Imitate everything on the face of the earth. And nothing.
The audio commentary on I don't know which versions of the DVD or Blu-ray have it, but I have a Blu-ray with commentary by John Carpenter and Kurt Russell, and when Wilford Brimley as Blair is freaking out and destroying all the computers and the communications, swinging an axe and shooting at people, Kurt Russell just kind of wryly says, "Wilford's a long way from the oatmeal commercials, isn't he?"
You know, what I was going to say, yeah, exactly. You know, I was going to say is Walker, Texas Ranger would have been a heck of a lot more interesting if we got some scenes like that.
Yeah. Well, you know, he called Liberty Medical and was able to calm down.
Keith David is probably one of the other.
David, thank you.
I don't know if he would have been a big name at this point.
I think, like Wilford Brimley, this was, if not his first, one of his very first roles.
Well, I mean, he would later on go to be, you know, one of the most memorable and certainly longest running John Carpenter fight scene in They Live.
So good, by the way. Should be watched by all.
But I think he makes he plays a really fantastic balance to Kurt Russell's character in this film as kind of the other strong, silent, brooding, suspicious guy. You know, in an alternate universe, he's the protagonist, I think.
Absolutely, absolutely. And I think Kurt Russell probably only is the protagonist because he was a bigger name at the time. But you're right, Keith David really does like provide he's like the straight man opposite to Kurt Russell's character, whereas other people are a little more flamboyant. Well, not flamboyant, but you know what I mean. They're a little more pigeonholed in terms of their roles. Those two are both kind of like the straight man characters.
Yeah. And I think one of y'all used the word ensemble earlier. One of the things I enjoy about this movie on rewatching it is because I'd always do remember it for Kurt Russell and Wilford Brimley and Keith David. But for about the first 30 or 40 minutes, it's not because you know who Kurt Russell is, you know he's going to be the main character. But if you didn't know who he was, it'd be really unclear at first who's going to step out of this and kind of take the lead. Because Kurt Russell's kind of passive at first. He's just sort of one of the guys. He's not even the quickest off the mark when the dog, you know, goes ape in the dog pen, you know. I just kind of enjoy that aspect of it. It's Kurt Russell's world weariness really comes across, and he is kind of forced to step up, which is it's really, really subtle, but it's there, and I kind of enjoy that.
Any praise we want to give to the minor characters who, spoiler alert, are not long for this world?
Yeah, I think to continue the kind of ensemble aspect of it, I think they're all the kind of movie I would compare this to is The Dirty Dozen, where you've got a whole bunch of characters and you get exactly enough to understand them, like who they are, so that they don't feel like a cardboard cutout.
Like, yeah,
like if we had time to just hang out with these guys, we'd get to know them more, but they feel like real people.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's down, I mean, to the quality of the performances, because you could certainly underplay these guys. But you feel like you, mm-hmm. you get them, particularly watching them. Just I like the observational quality of this movie, where it just kind of hangs back and lets you observe what they're doing, whether it's, you know, Keith David and his bunk mate, you know, sharing a joint, or, you know, the guys in the game room playing or whatever. So all the characters feel really, really well drawn, even if there's not actually much there on the page.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I would second that. There's a really good dynamic between them. And it, I mentioned, as something we'll talk about later, I do find it interesting that it is all men, but, you know, but some have said maybe that's just because it's the 80s, but I actually do think there might be something a little more going on there, but I'm not 100% sure. I have a theory, mm-hmm. though. I really do like the I like the character of Gary, who's, I think his name's Don Moffat or something.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. The one with the gun.
Yes.
And I mean, because he's like the commander, right? Like, he's the one in charge, more or less. But he does a good job, in particular, because what we see during this is, because of the paranoia, there's a pretty complete breakdown of any kind of chain of command. And really what we end up getting is sorry for the background noise there. What we really end up getting is a situation where the cleverest and strongest are going to be the ones who are running the show, and sort of watching him have to like get wedged out and having that conflict with Kurt Russell. And it's mm-hmm. he does a really good job in his role here in the film.
And he starts so confidently, you know, gunning down, even breaking a window in this Antarctic research station to gun down the crazy Norwegian. So he comes out really, really strong. And, you know, the one guy the guy who was smoking a joint in the bunkhouse, he even, you know, kind of rags on Commander Gary a little bit about getting a chance to shoot his gun and everything. So you think, I certainly remember the first time I watched this, I thought, oh, this guy's going to be a really big noise. It's going to be there's going to be some kind of conflict here, but he pretty quickly clearly realizes he's out of his depth.
Mm-hmm.
He has kind of a blue screen of death moment, you know, where he's just sort of staring. And then only when Kurt Russell takes charge and proves that he's human, does he kind of come back into his own and start helping Kurt Russell.
Yeah. Yeah. I like your phrase. He's out of his depth. There's a moment he realizes, and you can just kind of see it in his eyes. Mm-hmm.
And he has such expressive eyes.
Yeah, he just there's one scene that I remember when I was rewatching it a couple weeks ago. How sad I felt for him, because he just looked so lost.
Yeah,
and I was like, "Oh man, that this cannot be a good moment for this character." Who, as you were saying, you know, if you were watching this for the first time, you're expecting him to be, you know, kind of the hard bitten commander. Mm-hmm. Pretty quickly, what he's faced with takes a lot of that kind of assurance out of him. Well. One of the stars of the film, and everyone who anyone who's watched this would know and would agree that the effects practically need their own separate building. So who do we credit for the vision of the thing?
Well, we credit John Carpenter for wanting to do something more realistic than the movies he grew up watching, because he talked about how the horror movies he grew up watching were just like a man in a suit, right? Like a rubber suit.
Yep.
So he definitely had the desire for something more, not realistic, because it's not realistic, but something, well, it is though. It's something realistic, but also alien. And so for this film, he brought on a guy he had worked with in previous movies, I think. The guy's name is it's Rob something.
Botten.
I'm trying to remember. Botten, yeah.
Yeah, Rob Botten. And this guy worked I did a little poking around. This is, again, one of my favorite movies, so I've probably researched it more than a lot of the movies I've watched. But like, he worked 7 days a week for over a year to bring the practical effects in this apart together, which is why I think this movie holds up so well. Because CGI effects just, they get dated eventually, but the practical effects in this are always good. Yeah. And if I remember right, he was using things like mayonnaise, like foam latex, KY jelly, jam, like all kinds of weird stuff that he like brought it all together to make the goopiest, creepiest, like most amazing practical effects that I think, honestly, I'm not sure if there's too many people who even know how to do that anymore. The guy is genius though, because they are really, really good. And like I said, I think it could be argued, but I think they totally hold up even like 40 years later.
Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely agreed. I really wished that I could have found that DVD, because I think I remember there being some kind of a making of featurette on there with some interviews with him, with Rob on him. And it's been years since I watched it, but I still remembered him kind of telling stories of coming up with different effects and worrying about how it would play. And apparently he just wore himself out on this film. And it shows. Gosh, it shows. And you're right. Like,
it's a masterpiece.
I mean, for having come out 40 years ago, right? Yeah. 40 years ago this summer, it's still really, really amazing and viscerally. It's not just that we look at it and go, oh, why, my, that's very ahead of its time. It's like, oh no.
I will admit, and I've watched this movie many times, I still shiver every time I watch the head crawling away on spider legs.
Yeah.
Right behind Kurt Russell as he's like not noticing it.
Yeah. Whoa.
It's every time it's pure, like, just gross horror.
When those eye stalks come out.
Yep.
No. Oh yeah, the eye stalks. burn it with fire.
Yeah.
Oh man. But there's so much in here that I remember. You know, you remember the head and the eye stalks, but there's,
and the chest opening up when he goes to do the defibrillator.
Yeah. Yes. Yes.
That is one of the greatest like surprise moments the first time you watch it.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's just fantastic. I think it was maybe 14 or 15 when I saw it first, and maybe a little bit scarred. quite possibly. But I watched it in probably close succession with Predator and Aliens.
Mm.
I did the same, and I had the exact same experience. And I think that sequence of films, Predator, The Thing, Alien, and Aliens, is what made me become a horror fan somewhat later in life. Because when I saw this, I was not a horror fan as a kid, but like, you know, 6, 7, 8 years later, I kind of became one. And I think it's because those movies planted the seed of just how great it could be, the genre. Yeah. I mean,
absolutely. Well, is there anything that we want to say about other aspects of the film, like the score, or I mean, sound design certainly is really important to this film, like the just all of those just ungodly noises this creature makes.
Well, even the ambient noise, like to me, one of the great. So I would still say I'm not a horror fan, but I do like very specific horror movies, like the one y'all all just named. so this, The Shining, Alien and Aliens, Predator. There's maybe one or two others. All of which
nice, they're nice genre overlap films, like sci-fi horror, right? So like you can into one and not necessarily care for the other.
Yeah, but what all of them have in common is, for me, my own taste anyway, is a great deal of atmosphere. Because for me, a feeling of dread is much, much more powerful than just being grossed out by something. Like the gross out is great in this movie, but it's the anticipation of it that makes it so powerful. And the ambient noise.
I think that's John Carpenter's singular skill.
Yeah, for sure. And the noise, the ambient sound, whether you're outside with that just constantly howling Arctic wind, which just sounds lonely and cold. You know, everything. Then indoors, you know, there's the hum of, you know, somewhere in the background, you're kind of aware that there's a generator going. You know, this that kind of like general kind of ambient hum of a place that is built for functionality and not for comfort. You know, like a restaurant kitchen or something. You know, that kind of thing. Where even when it's quiet, it's never silent. And so that kind of hum, that kind of like, you know, the wind howling outside. All of that just builds so that, you know, you feel alone. It does feel cold, but there's also that like low background hum of anxiety, especially when this weird dog is just prowling around and finding people who are alone. So that is the creature noises, especially that horrible shrieking that it makes. Mm-hmm. That's one level, but like again, just the general atmosphere and I'm a sucker for good cinematography, and this looks great. Again, you know, really great use of anamorphic widescreen. Again, very good, bleak, cold exteriors and interiors. This movie, between the visuals and the sound, has a, like, texture, for lack of a better word. I mean, I would compare it to something like Lawrence of Arabia, where after Lawrence of Arabia, you feel hot and like you've got grit on your skin, you know, where here you feel alone and cold, like, you know, you need to take like a hot shower or something to like wake up your skin again or something. And then of course this is on top of, you know, this creature, mm-hmm. you know, absorbing people. So the atmosphere, I was just summing up the atmosphere is a huge part of it for me. Go ahead, sorry.
I was just going to say that I remember reading an article a couple of years ago that said, here's the best horror films to watch to cool off during this hot summer. And The Thing, of course, was one of them because of the atmosphere of it. Like, mm-hmm. no doubt, because it really does make you feel cold, not just cold, but also claustrophobic.
Yeah.
Because even when they're not in the building, they're outside, it's a storm going on, and that feels claustrophobic, right? Mm. It feels like you're being pressed in on, and it's freezing cold. And then the added layer of not being able to trust anyone is pretty brutal.
Exactly.
When it comes to the sound, what was that?
There's nowhere to run.
Yeah.
You know, you could just wander off and freeze.
Right, Antarctica is the perfect place for this.
Yeah.
There's no, you can't logically, like in a horror movie, you can't be like, you idiot, run away, you'll be fine. Like, you can't do that because there's nowhere to run. The only place to run kills you.
Yep.
Which really raises the stakes in an automatic kind of way. And is very explicitly Lovecraftian. It's the Mountains of Madness. It's, which is basically this, like, similar to this in that you're at you're in Antarctica, right? You're in this place where things are frozen and we don't know how long they've been there, and it's cold and you can't get away. But when we're talking about the score, I really want to, there's a couple, just a quick comment I want to make. And one is that John Carpenter, we need to understand, does not take the musical score of his films lightly. Mm-hmm. As evidenced by the fact that for most of his movies, he does the score. John Carpenter is actually a very interesting composer, uses a lot of synth. It's very 80s, but you think of the Halloween theme, right? Like, people who hear it probably know it and probably feel really uneasy with it, even if they've never seen the film, right? Mm-hmm. He is excellent at adding to the atmosphere, like Jordan was saying. Like, there's all these other sound effects and the screeching and the different things. I think everything Jordan said is correct, but like, we need a, like, John Carpenter is very, I would say punctilious about his scores. And the interesting thing is that this is one of the few films of his where he doesn't do the score. It's not him doing it. He actually gave this to a guy named Ennio Morricone, which is, I believe he's Italian. And the guy did a good job. It sounds like a John Carpenter movie. And the thing, the part that I like, what was that?
I'm just agreeing. You know, it doesn't sound like, I mean, you've heard other tracks from this fella. It like he did a lot of Sergio Leone's spaghetti westerns. He's done a lot of film score work, and unless you saw his name in the credits, you wouldn't know it.
Yeah.
Exactly. And my favorite sort of atmospheric one, though, is that there's a section, I think, there's this whole section where there's just a beat, like a heartbeat. It's just like bum bum.
Yes.
Bum bum. With like this very low level electronic sound behind it. And it is one of the most naturally tension building tracks that I've heard in a film. And in fact, I'm showing my nerd card full bore here. I used it in a D&D game, and it had exactly the effect that I wanted of creating unnatural and uncanny tension in and that's what it does in this film. Is like it makes you feel uncomfortable, like something terrible is about to happen, but you don't know what and you don't know when. So very, very good score by this guy Ennio, and again perfect for this film. I don't know that even Carpenter could have done better.
Well, one of the things that I wanted to bring into this, and I sent it along to you gentlemen, is when Carpenter was brought on to this project, it isn't the first film to deal with this source material, and the source material is a pulp story from the 1930s called Who Goes There? And it had been made into a film at least once previously. I believe, I think it's the Thing from Outer Space, if I remember right. And when Carpenter was brought on board, as you mentioned earlier, Carter, one of his intentions was for it not to be a guy in a suit, which is very much what that other film had been. It had been just kind of classic 1950s guy in a suit. So we looked at the story in that original source material, and I sent y'all a PDF that was scans of pages from the pulp magazine that it originally came with the original illustrations. So how would you characterize the source material, and then we can talk about the relationship of the film to its source material? Do you want to sum it up there, Jordan?
Sure. The first word that comes to mind for the original story is by a guy named John W. Campbell, who I was not familiar with, but apparently he was a really big name, not only in writing science fiction, but editing. Apparently he was a very demanding editor of a couple of science fiction pulps at a very, really, really influential and formative time for the genre. But this kind of helped make his name. But the first word that comes to mind for his original story is talky. I could very easily see this being adapted to the stage. Precisely. Not precisely as is, but there's a lot of stuff. There's lots and lots and lots of talk, like a surprising amount of conversation, especially if you're coming to this through the Carpenter movie, which has so much visual storytelling and long stretches of silence without you really noticing it.
Yeah.
But also most of the action, so to speak, happens off stage in the story. But it is really broadly similar to what Carpenter did with it. Many of the characters are the same. Carpenter greatly trims down the number of characters there are. There's almost 40 men at this research station, which is explicitly some kind of military expedition. So Commander Gary is not just in charge. He is like a U.S. Navy commander. And it's you know, they don't, you know, Campbell doesn't make, he doesn't lay out the explicit chain of command, but you get from the way they're talking and the expedition itself that, you know, what all is going on and that, you know, there's a military kind of overview here with maybe some civilian contractors or academics who have been seconded to the Navy or something like that, which is very much kind of par for the course for this kind of expedition in the 1920s and 30s. I believe it was published in 1938. Is that right?
Yeah,
38.
Mm-hmm.
So only 7 years after At the Mountains of Madness, which I think is interesting. But basically, it actually begins with the thing having been recovered, found near a spaceship frozen in the ice. They have cut it out of the ice and brought it back to their station. So no Norwegians chasing a dog in this version. It's kind of beginning in medias res. And MacReady is giving a as you know speech,
mm-hmm.
telling all the characters what they've just done for the benefit of the reader.
Yeah.
He basically just summarizes little
butler and maid dialogue.
Yes, exactly. So, you know, as you know, we picked up these readings and went to investigate and found this thing. And there's basically this debate, and interestingly, it comes down to, this weird, weird creature that already is scaring people, that is giving some members of the expedition nightmares, having spent several days dragging it back to the station across the ice, debating about whether they want to, thaw the thing out and dissect it and research it, which Blair, the biologist, points out this may be the only chance they ever get for this kind of thing, and other people who are too freaked out already by this and want to either just keep it frozen or get rid of it or something else. Naturally, they go with Blair. They set it up in a warm room to thaw out, and it is heavily implied that it is thawed and escapes, while another guy named Conant, whose character does not appear in the movie, taking like solar radiation readings or something like that. And then, you know, dot dot dot, the tension begins to build as there's a scene very, very similar to the dog kennel scene in the movie, which is where they first catch on to the fact that something is up with the dogs. The creature has escaped. It is apparently taking on the forms of other things. Blair, as in the movie, is the first person to figure this out and basically figures out the whole game just immediately. And like I said, off camera or off stage, so to speak, he's like, oh, yeah, and by the way, I got destroyed all the radios and pulled all the electronics out of the vehicle, so nobody's going anywhere. We're going to die here with this thing.
Yeah.
I feel like the story plays out pretty much the same with, there's a whole lot of business about protoplasm and how it's doing this and trying, unsuccessfully at first to figure out a test to determine who is and is not human.
Yeah.
Ultimately coming down to the test that is maybe the most suspenseful, intense scene in the movie, right? Of just plunging a hot wire into a blood sample and seeing how it reacts.
Mm-hmm.
That kind of thing. But it does end with a more conclusive, happy ending where it is gradually revealed that Blair, who goes crazy and is locked up for his own safety, he's actually one of the things and has become one at some point. They're able to eliminate him, save the day. And then there's, it ends with them going over some pieces of alien technology and what feels actually kind of like a little bit of an anticlimax. So
mm-hmm.
I really enjoyed, visiting this and reading it. But it is definitely one of the rare cases where I would say that a film adaptation improves on the source material. And I think it does that by taking, you know, first of all, taking account of the medium, mm-hmm. where Campbell's story is a novella published in a pulp magazine. It's got to communicate a lot of information in a way suitable to that medium. Carpenter takes those ideas and turns them into visuals, right? And mm-hmm. also he's got to get the thing into their camp somehow, and the device with the Norwegians like instantly introduces tension and bewilderment in a way that only builds for the rest of the movie. And I think the ambiguous ending is also a really big improvement over the story. But it's quite enjoyable. If you know, if you're listening to this and you haven't sought out the story to read it, I would recommend it. But it feels very 1938, not necessarily in a bad way, but in a way that I'm glad it served as raw material for somebody like Carpenter, if that makes sense.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, one of the things that I do like Carpenter did is that he kept some specific moments intact. Mm-hmm. He kept some specific moments. He kept some specific plot points, notably the blood test and the way the blood test works, the one that eventually works, the hot wire. So there's some, a lot of the names are kept. Not all of them, but many, many of the names, like MacReady, you know, there's a MacReady in the original story. There's a Dr. Copper. There's a Norris. Most of the names are pretty intact. Mm-hmm. So you can definitely see. And while you were summarizing that, Jordan, I was poking around at the earlier 1951 movie, which I got it wrong. It's not The Thing from Outer Space. It's The Thing from Another World, produced by Howard Hawks.
Yeah.
but looking at it, it actually has there are women in that movie, mm-hmm. and none of the character names are from the original story. So far as I can tell, there is a Dr. Voorhees, it's interesting to see how much that 1951 movie isn't present, except in one really important way, the title card.
Yeah. Yep. Which they just took precisely the same design, right? Just used just the first two words, the thing, right?
Yep.
Yeah. Well, if it ain't broke, don't fix it.
No doubt.
Well, it's interesting, you know, pointing that out. So I was telling y'all before we started recording. So I have a hard time, you know, reading off of a screen for a protracted amount of time. So I actually got a paperback of Who Goes There, which mm-hmm. I would recommend because it's first of all, it's got an attractive binding, whatnot, for a paperback, print on demand, no less. But it is it has an introduction by William Nolan, who is the co-author of Logan's Run, which I have neither read nor seen. I'm just kind of vaguely aware of it as a, you know, kind of classic 70s sci-fi sort of thing. The introduction is interesting. It tells you a little bit about the author, Campbell, the, you know, genesis of the story, the various film adaptations. But also, Nolan was tapped to write this introduction because in the late 70s, he had been approached by the studio to, you know, begin a new adaptation, a remake. And so this paperback actually includes his approximately, let me see how long this is. It's about 35 page screen treatment. So not a full screenplay, but basically a very, very detailed summary of what he would do with it. Mm-hmm. And it is like the 1951 version, very, very different. It is also very 70s. I can imagine Donald Sutherland being in it because I think there was some sort of constitutional amendment that he had to be in every movie in the 70s. like, seriously, I look up something from the 70s on IMDb, and like, oh, well, Donald Sutherland's in it. Of course he is. But it's you know, MacReady, instead of, you know, the kind of hard-bitten pilot mechanic that he is in both the story and the Carpenter movie, he is like a, how does he describe him in his screen treatment? Hang on, this was just, I rolled my eyes. Mac MacReady, a space physicist from UCLA. In his early 30s, a quirky, rebellious individual with a questing mind. And I'm like, okay, so it's a 70s movie then. Reading his screen treatment was really informative, and it really made me appreciate what Carpenter did with the source material, because he does hew really closely to it, using, like, not just using, but really making the most of what works in that original story, like you were laying out. Because this screen treatment by Nolan, it's, you know, it is like a co-ed operation. They all come from, you know, big West Coast universities, and they all act like it, you know, and there's various kinds of, you know, relationship drama and, you know, sexual tension, where there's like a mechanic who's, you know, the token misogynist because it's a 70s movie. And worst of all, though, is the you see what the things are up to most of the time. So they are, the crew is tipped off that something's going on when they see a UFO fly over their base and land on the opposite side of a ridge. And then three people with ray guns get out of it. So it's, I mean, we're back in 50s territory again. So there's just a lot less suspense. I mean, it's like somebody said, okay, take the Campbell story and make the most, you know, cliched 70s version of this you can. And yeah, so I mean, that's, you know, it's not great. So I mean, it was really informative, and I'm glad I read it. And like I said, it gave me a greater appreciation for Carpenter, because he lets the visuals do so much of the talking. And again, because he hewed so closely to what works in the original source material. It's, again, good visual storytelling, a good lived-in environment, and just a vibe among the characters that you pick up on without having explicitly to be, you know, to be told a lot of stuff. All right, I feel like I've been rambling, but
like we dodged a bullet.
Yeah, very. Yeah, and I'm going into detail about it because I think that's absolutely the case. Nolan, in his introduction, says, "I still prefer my treatment of the version of the movie to Carpenter's," and I'm like, "Well, you know, you have a proprietary right to that, I guess, but it's not good." So yeah, if that is an instructive read on how not to do this kind of thing and what could have happened to the story in lesser hands.
One of the things I really appreciated, setting John Carpenter's version over against Who Goes There, is how many animals there are at the camp in the original 1930s pulp version. There's dairy cows.
Yeah.
there seems to be just an absolutely enormous number of dogs. But when you think about it, of course there are, right? They don't have refrigeration. They don't have helicopters. Like they don't have a lot of the, you know, just the technology, the machinery, the all the different things that make life possible, that you see even in the 1982 movie, stuff that just wasn't there in the 1939, in the world of 1939, with the result that this outpost in the Antarctic probably necessarily has so many more people in it. You know, the point in the story when they discover that the thing has taken over all of the cows and they have been drinking thing milk.
Yeah. Yeah. That is the grossest moment of the story for sure. Well, like you read, you know, I don't have any kind of systematic, you know, understanding of the history of Antarctic exploration. I'm a dabbler. I just love that environment and reading stories about it. And, you know, you read like Ernest Shackleton or absolutely Cherry Gerard, who wrote a really great memoir called The Worst Journey in the World about being on the Robert Falcon Scott expedition that ended so badly. And yeah, I mean, they've got enormous teams of people just to support very small camps. And you know, when Scott, for instance, made his bid for the South Pole, he was taking, you know, 5 or 6 men, but it took the efforts of, you know, dozens of men making multiple kind of staging trips out toward the pole just to make it possible for that small team to go out there. So this very much feels, the Campbell story very much feels of a piece with that time period. Mm-hmm. With again the enormous number of people that it requires just to facilitate the, you know, I mean, you've got the cooks, you've got people presumably taking care of the livestock just to make sure that Blair can have his, you know, samples of whatever this creature is.
Mm-hmm. Well, Jordan, you mentioned earlier a reference to you made earlier a reference to Poe. And I think I saw you mentioned on social media maybe a couple weeks ago now, you were talking about reading the narrative of Arthur Gordon Pym.
Yes.
Did you end up finding anything that was related in that Poe material that seemed to connect back to this story in any way?
Maybe. It's hard to say. I'm really, you know, I finally got around to reading that because we were going to do this episode. Mm-hmm. And you know, anybody who heard our episode last year knows what a nut for Poe that I am, but I'd never gotten around to reading that whole thing. It was really, really good. Poe really keeps the story moving. I actually just finished reading At the Mountains of Madness today.
Yeah.
For the first time. And what I have to say for Poe against Lovecraft is that Poe keeps stuff happening. Mm-hmm. It is a brisk read with lots of stuff in it. There's cannibalism, you know, after you draw straws, stowaways, pirates, whaling, all kinds of stuff. But I think maybe its position in the thing DNA, so to speak, of this movie is just the scary apocalyptic Antarctic, not just as an object of exploration, but as a place where the strange and the terrifying happen. Because the narrative of Arthur Gordon Pym in the last quarter of the story, I guess. Having survived like a hurricane and some terrible storms, he and the last couple of survivors of this ship are picked up by a British whaler. They make a bid for the South Pole. So they push past these immense ice fields and paradoxically discover that beyond this certain parallel, the ocean starts getting warmer again. And they end up in this kind of high desert-like environment where there's all of these previously unseen native peoples who are terrified of anything white, whether that's your linen shirt or you know, a handkerchief or anything, smoke, you name it. If it's white, they're terrified of it. They wear all black, like animal skins, and basically have like this one shout. They shout anytime they see anything white. They eventually ambush Pym and all of his, you know, the entire crew of the ship, kill everybody but Pym and his one friend who's been with him the whole time, a guy named Dirk Peters, who's an interesting character. But they are able to escape in a stolen canoe with one native to guide them, and they keep pressing on southward, thinking maybe they'll find some way to escape that way, and end up in this insane cliffhanger ending, approaching what seems to be an immense waterfall, so probably some kind of hollow earth thing. Right, they've sort of like reached the drain at the bottom of the bathtub at the South Pole, and out of the immense mist rising in the distance, this huge white human-like figure in a white shroud appears, and the end. Which I don't think I had known that before I started reading it, but it is still eerie. So you take that kind of vibe of, you know, not only is this a dangerous, faraway place, but it is a dangerous faraway place where the otherworldly happens.
Mm-hmm.
Run that through Lovecraft, like Carter was pointing out, because, you know, having now read At the Mountains of Madness, absolutely, without At the Mountains of Madness, you do not get this version of who goes there, particularly in one scene. So a great deal of At the Mountains of Madness is just these academics flying to a faraway place, an abandoned, you know, million-year-old city, and just kind of, frankly, kind of farting around looking at statues for about 50 pages. I just finished it. It didn't thrill me. It was good, but, you know, that was kind of my impression. But what they're doing, right, is being introduced to this scary environment and having to figure out what happened. And I think one of the most effective scenes in The Thing is when they go to the Norwegian camp and try to figure out what happens. Yeah. So, and again, that's some of the strongest visual storytelling. Like, how did this bloody axe get in this wall? Mm-hmm. Why is there a guy who apparently cut his own throat and wrists? What is this thing that is like half burned in the yard? Mm-hmm. Why, you know, just, and I love basically any movie scene like that where a person is walking through a devastated environment, just trying to put together the puzzle pieces.
Yeah.
I like it when a filmmaker trusts the audience that way, and Carpenter does it exactly right. And again, that is not in the story. I think it is definitely a Lovecraftian thing.
Yeah.
And then of course the, not just the direct threat to the men at the camp, but the existential threat that the thing poses.
Mm-hmm.
Where the one place I would kind of push back on the Lovecraftian thing is I think Blair hasn't gone insane. I think he's actually reacting completely rationally, given the scale of the threat. He's just so rational, it seems cold-blooded. Like, you're going to consign us all to death, right?
I think that Carpenter definitely has, if we're looking in terms of weird fiction, I think he's definitely riffing on Lovecraft, but you're right, Jordan, he's definitely not. He doesn't have Lovecraftian protagonists.
Yeah.
Yes.
At least not typically. I think he would be more in the vein of a Robert E. Howard in this respect, mm-hmm. in that in this setting, we have a bunch of fairly testosterone heavy men. And they see this, you know, inexplicable evil, but rather than go insane from it, they say, okay, how do we kill it?
Yeah.
Is that possible, and how is it done?
It's the which Predator is much more reaction.
Conan than it is, you know, any of Lovecraft's protagonists.
Yeah
and there, you know, there are your, you know, your Blairs, who is running his weird biology prediction computer, you know,
his weird little Pong video game.
Yeah, but you've also got, I mean, MacReady is basically just a helicopter pilot. And Childs is, you know, just a mechanic. And what's his face? I blanked on his name. The dog handler.
Yes.
Clark. He is the guy who handles the dogs, you know. And so it's like a bunch of, it's very much like Alien, which is about space truckers. You know, it's like these are a bunch of, you know, mechanics in a very, very exotic location supporting a very small number of academics.
And that is Carpenter. I mean, that is I have and will continue to call him a blue collar auteur, because what he does is he makes really interesting films, but he doesn't have a posh sensibility, for lack of a better term. Like, he deals with blue collar working people, and that's who he puts in most of his movies. The quote unquote sequel to this, loosely, Prince of Darkness, which I just recorded on last night with Danny and Nathan Gilmore, it does deal with academics, but for the most part, Carpenter's exploration of humanity is with the working class, with the union man, with the construction worker, with, you know, greasy working people, not not people who are delicate, shall we say.
Yep.
Which is, well, one of Kurt
Russell's that, later going to go on to play not a space trucker, but a trucker.
But yeah, that makes it feel very real. And if somebody like, so according to their commentary, right, this is not in the text anywhere, so to speak, on screen. Apparently what Carpenter and Russell imagined for MacReady was that he was kind of emotionally scarred Vietnam veteran, right? A helicopter pilot. You imagine him flying a Huey in, you know, the Mekong Delta like 10 years before, and he's self-medicating with alcohol. So, I mean, if this is the kind of guy, you know, even if you don't know that about him, you get that vibe. And if this guy is rattled by what he's seeing, that, without having to explicitly lay it out, tells the audience what a threat this thing is. Which, again, I like that. I like that when a filmmaker is, you know, trusts the audience enough to let us figure it out just by watching well-performed characters.
Carter, you mentioned earlier that you had a theory about the all-male cast in this film. Is that the Robert Howard side of the fiction is that part of your solution?
Yeah. So I definitely think that there's a strong vibe in this movie of, I know that he's dealing with source material, and the source material has just men, if I remember correctly. But, you know, it's the 1980s, and in the 1980s, I imagine that women were allowed on expeditions of this kind. It wasn't quite so monolithic in terms of who was allowed to do such, you know, do science, so to speak. So my theory here is that, yeah, he's using, I think, the fact that it's all males to create a kind of tension where each one of these males who are vying for sort of an alpha status. And I think that works better when it's males than if you were to have a mixed company, so to speak. I think a mixed company would make it potentially more difficult to pull off in a believable way. And that's not saying that women can't be strong characters, but in 1982, it wasn't non-existent, but it was rarer, right? So I do think that there is something here where he is making some commentary about the kind of it's a bit Lord of the Flies, right? When you put a bunch of guys into a situation like this, there becomes almost a level of brutality or cruelty that they're willing to perpetrate against each other when they have this lack of trust and when there's this vying for power, vying for authority. So I think it's intentionally, shall we say, testosterone driven to some degree, because it's giving us an image of kind of the lengths that people will go to in a certain kind of social environment and social context. And if you put eight guys in a situation that's high stress where their lives are threatened, what happens? Now, how much of that is Carpenter making an explicit kind of commentary on maleness? I don't know, but I have pulled at that thread a little bit, and I do think there's something there. Just given how violently and how callously they can be willing to let each other die or to kill each other in order to survive this, and how much like the fight for who gets to be in charge becomes a sort of major focal point in the conflict in the film, right? Like a lot of this is just about, well, who gets to be in charge, right? And it becomes what I grew up calling a pissing match, right? Like that's what it becomes in many ways. So I'd love to hear if you guys have any thoughts on that, if you think I'm overreading it, or maybe it's just, you know, Carpenter doing his thing and not really thinking about it. But that's sort of my general take on the very specific gendering of the cast in this film.
Go ahead, David.
I mean, there are a lot of scenes where how it turns out really does depend on who gets to the flamethrowers or dynamite first. What were we going to say, Jordan?
I was just going to say it's interesting you mentioned Lord of the Flies, because it has been a long time since I've read up on that. But I remember Golding somewhere, the author of Lord of the Flies, saying that he had intentionally made that a strictly boys' school that had wrecked on that island in order to focus the tension in the story in a way that having a co-ed dynamic would have, you know, diffused or redirected some of the tension, you know, where making it a purely survival story, where I, you know, I can definitely see, like I said, talking about that Nolan treatment for his own version of the thing earlier. Yeah, some of the tension is diffused in that version because there is this like male versus female aspect that is distracting from the threat the thing poses to everybody. So I guess I don't know if that has to do with the themes, but I think maybe functionally, structurally in the story, that's one of the ways that he's trying to create and sustain to take it back to Poe, a kind of unity of effect, right? Make overcomplicate the situation, and the thing is not going to be the main thing you're scared of, if that makes sense.
Yeah, and I think that's probably some part of it. Is it's just simpler.
Yeah,
you don't have any fear of a love interest in this movie, which is kind of nice actually. Like, there's no, you know, hot girl to get at the end. There's just, you either live or you get consumed.
Yeah,
and that's the focal point. So I think that is fair. At the same time, again, I think there's an escalation of tension because, you know, it's a bunch of guys and guys, you know, the rough and tumble type of guys like I grew up with. They tend to come at each other. They tend to escalate. They tend to try to one up each other and feel threatened when someone else is trying to take charge.
Escalation is definitely the word.
Yeah. It's y'all were mentioning earlier the way this ensemble cast works, and we get to see in much earlier in the film what it looked like when they were just hanging out, you know, ragging each other, picking on each other, playing ping pong, watching, you know, reruns of game shows. We got to see what it was like when it was, you know, a bit more like a frat house and less like Lord of the Flies. But the way that they turn on each other is, is part of the horror, honestly.
Yeah.
I mean, one of the characters who draws the most suspicion early on is Clark, the dog handler. And he always he presents as not quite in phase with any of the other guys. He'll just sort of look at you instead of talking, right? He seems to be much closer to much more emotionally connected to the dogs than he is to the other humans that he's with. And so there's this suspicion that because of his early on contact with this alien creature in dog form, that he himself has been replaced. And in, you know, a really important conflict scene, he comes at Kurt Russell's character with a scalpel, with a bladed implement, and is shot. And after that, they give him the blood test, and it turns out he was Clark. He was not replaced. This was the guy that they knew that had been shot. And it's I think a really effective layer on here, onto the tension and the horror in this film. It's not just that they need to be afraid that other guy whose eyes they're looking into has been replaced. Right. And the one that they're looking at isn't the one that they think it is. It's, but what if he is? And I've already made, you know, I've made that turn to a kind of final violence, and then I discover I was wrong. I found that a really effective moment. They don't spend a lot of time on it in the film because they can't really. There's too much tension, but there's at least enough time to say, so he was human and that makes you a murderer.
Yeah, yeah, and I mean, I think that this movie reminds me a lot of the Twilight Zone episode, "The Monsters Came to Maple Street," which is very, very similar, right? Everyone turning on each other, accusing each other, trying to figure out who the culprit really is, and I do think it. I mentioned this before the show about something I wanted to, you know, mention or discuss. Is I really think this reflects the sort of late Cold War context that a lot of movies were riffing on during this time. Like this is the time of supreme paranoia that the person next to you could be, you know, one of the enemy, right? They look like you, they sound like you, they eat like you, they dress like you, but they are in fact from the other side, and you don't know if they are or not, and that's supposed to fill you with fear. I do wonder, yeah, it's complicated a little bit in this because there is an actual monster.
Yeah.
Like, it's not just a commentary on how this is bad, because there is actually a thing trying to kill you.
Right. It's like Crucible.
So I don't know if it's subversive. Maybe it's subversive. Maybe it's of that. I don't know.
It would be like the Crucible, except that the witches are real and they're eating people.
Right. Which kind of loses some of that effect.
So the witch.
Yeah.
So I don't know if there's a clear kind of Cold War critique or satire or subversion going there. I'm not sure if that was necessarily what he was. Maybe that's not what he was after at all, but it definitely strikes me as like it can't just be coincidental that in a time of extreme paranoia, what we have is a movie about extreme paranoia.
Well, he had he had the source material. So the story in 1939 is also deeply paranoiac. I mean, the title,
but prior to the Cold War, right? Yeah, so that, exactly. That's significant. Very significant.
I mean, prior to World War II even. But that I think is a big part of it, is that even though it is prior to the Cold War, it is in the lead up to the Second World War. And the sort of the big memory in that pulp era is how the Great War played out, and remembering that the enemy in the Great War was the European enemy. Again, you know, not Russia, but Germany. And so that, again, that idea that, you know, the one that we might have to face is, you know, the Germans again. And oh wow, gosh, give it a couple of years and that's what it was. But that paranoia, it transposes, right? I mean, just like the ancient alien material does. I mean, maybe Campbell is drawing more on Lovecraft's Ancient Aliens, but the guy in the vest who's kind of a punk and he's smoking joints and stuff. But he makes
the roller skater.
Yeah. Well, no, that's the cook.
Oh, right.
I can't remember his name, but
I can't remember his name. I just know
Chariots of the Gods, right? He's making a reference to Eric von Däniken's work, that gets popularized in kind of the early and the mid 70s. So, even though there's this material that's presented in the 1939 story source, the paranoia, the ancient aliens, the Antarctic setting, Carpenter has updated those elements into forms that would be familiar to the audience in 1982. And I think that ends up making it feel not like a period piece, not like that 1951 guy in a suit movie, but it ends up feeling like something that's both contemporary and, but also not, not kind of overly topical, if that makes sense. Because these ideas were things that had been in the original source material, even albeit in a different form, he's able to kind of show, you know, these are both old and current
ideas. And and current now even too. So like maybe that's one of the reasons why it's aged so well, is that we kind of just went from the Cold War to the War on Terror, and it really hasn't changed all that much in terms of like people's suspicion and paranoia.
Mm-hmm. Well, I've been thinking about the ways that this film shows up in other media, and one of my favorite versions of the thing that isn't the thing is it's either the first or the second season of the X-Files.
Yep.
I thought
of the X-Files as well. Yeah.
Yep. And there's that there's a research station above the Arctic Circle, so it's the North Pole, not the South Pole, but they've got people committing suicide. They've got people's personalities being taken over. Who's infected? You know, it's the thing all over again. How do we develop a test for it? It's pretty cool. And one of my favorite kind of more recent audio drama podcasts is The White Vault.
Yes.
Okay.
That's a good show. I really enjoy that show. Yeah.
Which again has very much a very similar feel to this. There's something about this material that even though the film we're talking about is 1982, it's based on something from 1939, which is riffing off of Lovecraft, which is, you know, 7-8 years earlier, which is riffing off of Poe, which was, you know, and there's something perennial here, something that you can kind of almost endlessly refresh, which I think is part of what makes it so strong. Mm-hmm. Well, is there anything else we want to note before we go? I got my reference to Eric Von Däniken in, so I feel like I've satisfied Danny on that point.
I would just draw attention one more time to the ambiguity, not just of the ending, but of pretty much the whole movie. When exactly does Blair become a thing? That's gonna really change the way you interpret a lot of his actions, you know. Uh-huh. Is he wrecking the communications and the vehicles at the camp so that the thing can't get out, or so that the other guys can't get away? You can watch this multiple times, and I mean, you can read Wilford Brimley many different ways. You can read a bunch of the other characters multiple different ways. You know, Keith David, even Kurt Russell. I personally tend to think Keith David and Kurt Russell both make it through to the end, but of course they're going to freeze.
Yeah.
But I could be wrong.
But they will freeze as heroes, man.
Yeah. Well, you know, and that is not the first time somebody would have heroically frozen to death in the Antarctic. Go read about Robert Falcon Scott again sometime. I really love that. And again, ambiguity can be done badly. I feel like it is done expertly in this movie to increase the uncertainty and the tension, but also resolves enough so that you don't feel like you're left hanging.
Yeah.
Yeah, I would say that I would give this movie a full score for perfect endings. In that, if this movie had too much of a conclusive or note of finality to it, I think it would still be good, but it would cheapen it a little bit. I think it ended perfectly for the vibe and the atmosphere that the movie was going for, which is you never really know. At the end, and I find that just you know, chef's kiss, mwah. Right? the only other thing I'd say, and it's actually not about this film, but it's a recommendation I made on The Prince of Darkness as well, is that if someone likes Carpenter's take on the cosmic horror, they might also enjoy an author named Michael Shea. The late author Michael Shea, he wrote a number of stories in the Lovecraft mythos, but instead of writing Lovecraftian characters, he wrote characters almost all set in San Francisco, who are like homeless, they're prostitutes, they're working people, like, you know, like grease and dirt on their hands kind of folk, right? The blue, again, it's very much like a blue collar Lovecraft vibe, and it fits really well with the John Carpenter take on this kind of horror. And his short stories of these sort of, you know, we'll call unseen folk in San Francisco encountering cosmic horrors is really reminiscent of Carpenter and really well done in a similar way. He even has one set in the Antarctic, actually. So Michael Shea, if folks are looking for something similar to this, where you have like, again, like blue collar folk encountering the cosmic horror and figuring out how to deal with it, I think you could do a lot worse than checking out his work.
Awesome. Well, I think that's all we have for this episode, dear listeners. I hope that if you haven't persuaded, if you haven't watched the thing, I hope that we persuaded you to do so. And if you have done so, we've given you some more thoughts to have about that. I thank Cole Neal for inviting me to take the helm on City of Man for this year's Christian Humanist Radio Network Halloween crossover. And thank you to Jordan Poss and Carter Stepper for coming on and supplementing me with their really developed thoughts and deep knowledge on these subjects. Thank you, gentlemen.
One more thing to say, David.
Oh.
Maybe we should just sit here a while.
Yeah.